Picard, if you had half the sense you pretend to have, you would get her off your ship immediately. And if you'd like, I'd be more than pleased to expedite her departure.
You know him?
We have had some dealings.
Those dealings were 2 centuries ago. This creature is not what she appears to be. She's an imp. And where she goes, trouble always follows.
You're speaking of yourself, Q, not Guinan.
Guinan? Is that your name now?
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where 2 Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, pondering about all those things that I just have not figured out yet.
Okay, and now for this week's conundrum, Star Trek's unsolved mysteries.
Yeah, Cam, we can't help but notice that there are a lot of lingering questions about the franchise, where we leave the characters, or how we get from A to B, and they never really explain it through any given series.
Or also, you know, story threads are picked up on and then dropped because something better comes along. You know, that's what happens when you have an episodic series going week to week to week for countless years on end. And so it's raised a lot of questions I think fans love to pick apart. Now, before we proceed with some of these kind of burning questions of Star Trek, I think we need to just say up front, look, we know that a lot of the Star Trek novels or, tie-in merchandise have, or games or what have you, have answered some of these questions. And I think we are not going to be really acknowledging that too much because, you know, the people that create these games or TV shows or comic books or whatever, they're fans. They are as driven as we are to answer these questions. And so, you know, I look at those books or comics or whatever as their answers to these questions, but not as the definitive answer.
No, they're non-canon, essentially, so it's kind of like... And besides, I think the only books that we've read between the two of us, you've read, what, Die Spock Die, Desperate Hours? Extreme Measures?
Okay.
Generic Discovery book title?
Desperate Hours.
Desperate Hours. Yeah. I've read Stitch in Time, The Black Shore, a Q novel.
Yeah.
I don't know. To me, it's about half a dozen books.
Yeah, and I've watched some of the fan films, too, which answer some questions. But again, it's fans, you know, like ourselves, just desperate to answer some of these questions.
Yeah.
And I think it's more fun to kind of kick them around as fans and try and figure out what we think is the better answers.
And also just a lot of things that maybe listeners haven't even thought about as
sure.
well. So, Cam, yeah. Why don't I throw it to you? Why don't you bring up the first kind of unsolved mystery or burning question that you might have about Star Trek?
Okay, I'm going to start with one that maybe sounds a little mundane on the face of it, but I think is an interesting thing
to
kind of
consider. Great way to start off the podcast, Cam.
Well, okay. Star Trek Voyager introduced us to the Doctor, the EMH. And, you know, we saw through that series that, you know, he gets the mobile emitter, he's fully functioning, he can journey around the rest of the ship. What is the future for human doctors on Starfleet ships in the future?
I know, because we even had like the Dr. Lewis Zimmerman pursue that on Deep Space Nine,
yeah.
And then with Reg Barkley during that little that arc that they had there.
And we were introduced to other EMHs too that were more advanced.
Do we just need to get rid of doctors at this point? Are they facing the same dilemma we are with automation right now, where the AI is taking all our jobs?
Like, Star Trek is sort of this grand utopia where everyone gets to do what they're passionate about. But is there an advantage to an EMH that is just not there for a human doctor? Because the doctor, as portrayed on Voyager, seemed incredibly competent.
But it took him a while to get there. Like, yes, competent, but...
But he was also an earlier model. Like, what are the later models? Because they're not going to stop with him, right?
Yeah. So what do you do? Because are there not other sorts of jobs that could be replaced by holograms on the ship? We had the ECH, the Emergency Command Hologram, in that one episode.
I don't know that I trust an ECH so much, but maybe like an engineering?
But why not an ECH versus, say, an EMH or an EH?
I don't know. I just don't want the person at the top of the food chain being a
hologram.
Robot. Yeah.
But it seems as if anybody could essentially be placed by holograms at this point. Maybe they have one of those kind of dilemmas, or they're like, maybe we should not be pursuing holographic sentience. That's just something that seems almost dangerous, you know, to our way of being.
But Voyager never
acknowledged.
Yes, yeah. Never acknowledged that fact, and if anything, made the Doctor more and more of a, you know, valuable member of the crew. So by the time they're journeying home at the end of Endgame to Fireworks, you know, what is the future? Because they're going to come back, and you know, the Doctor is something of a hero on the ship. He's a, you know, he has a role on that ship that is possibly bigger than any other holographic Doctor that exists during that, you know, the Voyager's absence from Earth and what have
well,
you.
Well, let's workshop this. Let's try to explain why this doesn't happen. I would point to, say, maybe the mobile emitter. Maybe there's something special about that mobile emitter that the Doctor could only get so far with his programming up until season, what, 3 or 4 when we were introduced, season 3, yeah. When we were introduced to that. And then that, which is pretty early in the season's run, or the series run.
They were desperate to get him out of that room.
I think so. And so what? So you're 2 full seasons in at this point, because we only had like half a season for season 1.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he probably hit his limit for growth there.
Sure.
He gets this piece of 29th century technology. Maybe the people in the 24th century just can't reverse engineer it.
Oh, come on. You know they'll figure it out.
I don't know. It's would you be able to figure out some technology? Okay, no. Let's say
Cam. Yeah.
I bring an iPhone back to Leonardo da Vinci. Does he figure it out? Does he start building his own iPhones in Florence?
I don't know. We have to find him in Concept of Flight and ask him.
Or Concerning Flight.
Or Concerning Flight.
Yeah. No, that's what I'm saying. I could buy.
I don't know if Khan could create 23rd century weapons. And he was from like the 1990s.
Did he actually create 23rd century weapons? We didn't ever have any evidence of that in
No, I don't think
Into Darkness.
That, but he was working on them.
He was working on them. He was conceptualizing them. Yes. Is that another unsolved mystery, Cam?
That's one I don't want to ponder.
Well, I'm with you there. The Doctor, what does the future hold for Doctors in Star Trek after we have the EMH? I'll say it has to do with the mobile emitter. That makes them special.
But don't you think they would continue developing this technology?
They would try, but how can they reverse engineer it? They don't know how.
Yeah, I question what the future is for a human Doctor at that point. Yeah. Like, you know, they don't tend to go backwards. You know, they're not. I feel like they're not
putting leeches on their bodies anymore. No?
I feel like
not a barber surgeon.
I feel like they're not going to scrap that program and be like, just bring us more Dr. McCoys.
Yeah.
You know, it's like
maybe the doctors have a great union in the 24th century, and yeah.
Well,
okay.
Are they paid? Do you need?
That's a very
union?
Good point. Yeah.
That's a whole other burning question.
Well, my burning question, though, and this is one I think a lot of fans have been wondering about. What exactly ever happened to Tom Riker? Remember, we had him in the episode, I think it was actually called Defiant.
Right.
And this was on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Is that season 2?
I think it was season 3. Season 3, because it was before Worf came on. Remember, Riker had that encounter with Chief O'Brien?
Yes.
And he just says, he knows what he did. And as an audience member watching that, I was just like, wait, what happened? Like I thought I had missed something big between those Will and Miles. And
that episode's kind of a missed opportunity in that they didn't hold it for another year, because it would have been really fun to have Worf there.
Oh, yeah, totally. So anyways, he gets, by the end of this episode, he gets captured by the Cardassians. He's a Maquis member. He has to go to Cardassian prison. And Kira says, don't worry, I'll get you back.
Right.
Nothing ever happens. Whatever happened to Tom Riker? I want to know what's going on during the Dominion War. Does he make some dramatic escape? He was meant to be kind of a big character in that. Remember, there was even talks of him being the captain of the USS Voyager. Like, they wanted Jonathan Frakes back, but he wouldn't play Will. He'd play Tom. I don't know. Whatever happened to Tom?
Do you think he got out of that prison in the timeline we saw on TV?
Maybe Dominion War ends and he's released?
Like, kind of like the finale of DS9 or something, you know, around that time period. Do you think he's released, or do you think he's kind of ignored? Is he like those poor POWs in Rambo First Blood Part 2 who are still in Vietnam?
No, I'm going to go back to my Voyager history. And remember when, I think it was after Message in a Bottle, and they started communicating with the Alpha Quadrant?
Mm-hmm.
And Chakotay goes to B'Elanna and says, everyone in the Maquis has been wiped out. Do you think the Cardassians are actually leaving this one Maquis member alive?
Oh, good question.
I think Tom might be dead. I think he's got himself croaked in a Cardassian prison.
So we see at the end of that episode he's being handed over to them. How quickly do you think they would execute him?
I don't.
Do you think he'd be there a while, or do you think it would be fairly quick?
I'd say maybe he's got some time.
Okay.
You know, because I think the Maquis were wiped out in season 5.
Okay.
So, in this is season 3. I would say, yeah, maybe by the time they had the entire, like, Maquis purge. Because it didn't... I think the Maquis purge happened after the Cardassia joined the Dominion. And that's what made it possible.
Right.
So, yeah, I would say that's when it happens. Probably season 5 of Deep Space Nine. So, maybe Kira only has a 2-year window to go rescue Tom Riker.
She got occupied with other things.
There's all that time with Shakar that she needed to spend. I don't blame her. No.
Yeah, it's true. Once Shakar comes in, you're like, ah, Tom Riker who?
It was great when I was in Star Trek Las Vegas, and we had Iris
Stephen. You were dressed like Shakar.
Yeah, he's my favorite, yeah. Yeah. We had Iris Stephen Bear. He was begging fans to go up in front of this camera and just talk about, like, what you maybe don't like about Deep Space Nine. I think he was getting a lot of people, but this is for the What We Left Behind documentary. He's getting a lot of people saying, like, oh, I love this about Deep Space Nine. I love that.
You mean people like me?
Yeah, pretty much. And he was begging people, just give us your criticisms. Tell us what you don't like.
I wish he'd been there when I did mine to ask me something like that. Because I would have actually had answers, but they didn't prompt me to do anything like that.
Yeah. I was more than happy to share the fact that it seems as if Kira just got hooked up with a whole bunch of duds with, like, zero charisma.
Right.
I saw in the corner of my eye, Iris Stephen Bear actually clapped just a little. He could appreciate that criticism. So, Tom Riker, I think he had some... Didn't they? Those two have some chemistry, though?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, who doesn't Jonathan Frakes have chemistry
that's
with?
That's true.
Yeah, I liked that episode...
Minuet?
No, I liked that episode gave Tom Riker... more of a personality, I felt, than the TNG one.
Yeah.
The TNG one, they kind of played him maybe a little too close to just being like the Riker clone, but just the kind of the less successful one. Whereas I felt when we got to that DS9 episode, he was a character who stood on his own.
So do you think he spent his time in the prison camp just, I don't know, making new phaser imprints of, you know, like his phaser art?
Oh, that's right. He did make phaser art.
Yeah. I don't think they'd give him a phaser, which is disappointing, but still...
What do you think happens in a Cardassian camp that he would go to? Is it like a labor camp? Like, is he mining? Because it seems like in Star Trek, people are always mining.
You know, I think he would have a lot of experience in a dank subterranean sort of facility. Like he spent all those years on in the episode Second Chances.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think it's probably a mining colony of some sorts. And he's getting a lot of soot on his face before he's... shown the guillotine.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
And he has like a Sydney Carton-like ending. It's a far better place I go to than I have ever known.
Cameron, what's next on your list, sir?
Okay. I want to talk about Star Trek The Motion Picture.
About the only one, but go on.
The film ends with the grand joining of V'ger with Decker. And we are told that the human adventure is beginning.
Yeah.
Tyler... whatever happened to the human adventure? do you think, like, what happened with this? Because this was presented as a very momentous event in what would be the history of the Star Trek future, of the melding of machine and man, essentially. Was this, do you think, I mean, look, we can spitball back and forth about what happened to Decker and Ilya, but...
That's never how I interpreted the human adventure to be. To me, it's the conclusion of the movie, and they're like, we're just revving up. Now the human adventure begins.
Really? You see, I felt like that was the next step of evolution for humanity.
Okay.
And that was the human adventure.
I really like that interpretation. So, okay. But but let me say this, though. Yeah. Gene Roddenberry's always been a humanist. Like, everything that we see in the world, the pyramids, the great architecture... it comes from man's ingenuity, not because of higher beings or higher forces.
Right.
So then if he's all of a sudden saying, now that we've ascended to this kind of higher being, now the human experience can really begin, I think that actually knocks down kind of the Gene Roddenberry point of view.
Interesting. So, interesting. Yeah.
But let's say, okay, Decker, Ilya, the human adventure is beginning with those two as higher beings. I'm sure there's a lot of antechambers that they're traveling through. About 17 or 18.
Do you?
There's a lot of light shows, clouds, dust. Cam, I'd fall asleep. The human adventure sounds really boring to me.
Do you think, you know, motion picture comes out, it's a big hit financially, but fans not big on it. Assume for a second that it was beloved by fans. Would this been a thread we would have seen continued in Star Trek II?
Like, no.
You don't think so?
It just wasn't that era of filmmaking.
Right.
You know, I mean, let's be honest. You've got the Star Wars trilogy coming out concurrently with this.
Right.
Is this really kind of the parallel you want between Star Trek and Star Wars? We're going to be exploring dust clouds.
Right.
I think whatever we would have gotten, if this was a big success, even though it was successful,
it was
at the box,
yes,
office,
yes,
just not necessarily,
but like people ridiculed it even at the time,
yeah. But let's say it was a critical hit and they're, yeah, like, Gene, we want you sticking around producing all these movies, writing all these movies. I think we would have had more of those kind of explorations of, say, what was it, Star Trek the Titans, or more of that kind of god sort of themes that we had.
Yeah, search that out on Memory Alpha, listeners. Star Trek Titan, I believe it's called, or Titans,
yeah,
which was a kind of scrapped script idea for another film.
Well, Cam, let me ask you this. How do you envision the human adventure?
I mean, the way I looked at it was, you know, we've seen on the show up until this point, it's Kirk and the crew on the ship exploring the cosmos. To me, the joining of V'ger and Decker is like the next step of man exploring the cosmos, but without sort of the limitations of, you know, the equipment that the crew is working with. Like, there's no Starfleet required. It's this, like, perfect being that can just journey, kind of like the Silver Surfer.
Okay. Or yeah, even, like, the transporter device that 1990s Khan built in Star Trek Into Darkness.
That, too.
Just takes you everywhere in a flash.
Well, his nickname was the Human Adventure. So.
Oh, okay. I dig. Is Stamets maybe the next...
That's an excellent question.
Part of the human adventure here.
I mean, as much as a lot of fans have online said, you know, Discovery is not Star Trek, there have been a constant...
And fans on our show.
There have been a lot of homages or nods to elements of other Star Trek series. Lots and lots of them. Do you think Stamets is sort of... Look, I don't know that they're really paying homage to the motion picture, but... We've seen elements of this, like with the Traveler, also is like these kind of these beings that can just kind of journey through the cosmos. Q.
Salamander Tom Paris.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Breaking the Warp 10 barrier. Yeah. Is Stamets like kind of following in the tradition of the human adventure? Which I just really like calling the Ilya-Decker combo.
It's very possible. I'd say so. Okay, so... Journeying through the cosmos. It sounds fun to me, but I think, you know, you'd have to take your time with it.
It would get lonely.
That's why Decker and Ilya have each other.
Yeah.
Although, it's not really Ilya, is it?
No, it's not.
It's just a carbon copy of her.
Well, it's like downloaded her memories, essentially.
But it's not her, forgive me, not that I believe in souls, but it's not her soul within.
Not from what the movie's... indicates. No.
So I think Decker's got like a lonely journey ahead of him.
Yes.
So,
well, like the Silver Surfer, he'll be like out there pondering, you know, humanity and etc.
Did you catch the Cadet Decker shout out on Star Trek Discovery in the last episode?
No, I didn't.
There was something on something came over the PA system where they're like, Cadet Decker, please report to blah, blah, blah.
Oh, wow.
Which actually, if you think about it, it actually makes sense in the timeline.
Yes, definitely.
He'd have about what? 15, 20 years to make it to captain?
Yeah.
So, I buy that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, actually. Yeah. Decker, you know, a character who's never acknowledged, really, in Star Trek. After that movie, they were just like, let's ignore Decker and Ilya forever.
Yeah, but...
And Decker was like their bright, shining hope for the future of Star Trek at one point in time when they were putting together the new Voyages.
Although, if we hear what we've heard about that actor, I don't think they really want to do too many Decker shoutouts.
Hashtag awkward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next for me, Cam, why don't I talk about a TNG unsolved mystery?
Okay.
Geordi's visor. Whatever happened to it?
Yeah.
We did see he had like the new, you know, like ocular implants as of Star Trek First Contact. If there was an episode, if there was a season 8, you know, between Generations and First Contact, there would have been a whole episode devoted to him getting rid of the visor, right? It was a big deal.
Do you think they would have ever gotten rid of the visor on the TV show?
I think it's too synonymous with the character.
Yeah.
and you just didn't do that in television back in the day.
Yeah.
And I think the reason they got rid of it on the film is because LeVar Burton said, I ain't doing this with the visor on. So sorry, guys.
Is Geordi's visor the equivalent of the Mystique blue makeup in the X-Men Apocalypse?
Where they rewrite the character.
Yes. Where the actor is finally like, enough is enough. I'm not wearing this anymore.
I think so. But to me, it's intriguing because it's such, you know, part of his identity at this point.
Yeah, and how do you feel about Geordi without the visor?
It's not really the same Geordi. And I, like, if I was somebody who had, I don't know, visual impairment, I feel like there's just one less kind of role model out there, because what makes Geordi distinct now? Because even when we saw it from his point of view in First Contact, and he was watching Cochrane drink alcohol.
Right.
It looked like normal vision, but just kind of like infrared sort of illuminated sort of stuff. It wasn't that different than what he had before, or than what another person would see things. So I don't know. I think we lost something with Geordi in the movies, even though he never really had that much to do in the movies in the first place.
Right. Well, I think, I agree with you. To me, Geordi lost a lot in those movies, in the sense that, like,
Data, his best friend.
He didn't care. No, I mean, Geordi in those films was given, as you said, very little. But what you could always rely on with Geordi is that he was incredibly iconic because of the visor.
Yeah.
You know, on the Next Generation TV show, in episodes where he wasn't doing a lot, just him being there, you instantly, you know, he kind of caught your attention. When you removed that, it didn't do wonders for him kind of standing out in the crowd to a certain degree.
Yeah.
You know, you put Geordi in those films with the visor, you're looking at him.
He just felt like just another dude on the ship.
Yeah. I think if you were going to do that and remove the visor, I think you have to make it sort of a little more tied into the story in a way where it's interesting, or we have some sort of emotional connection to it happening.
Look, this is the Borg movie. They could have given him those ocular implants or something. That would have been cool.
Yeah, well, they were never going to do that because, you know, half the crew was pretty much ignored in the films. But to me, if you're going to make that kind of change, you want to involve the audience in it emotionally. Otherwise, it just feels weird.
Yeah.
And it just didn't quite feel like Geordi, and there was no moment of transformation for the audience to kind of get invested in. And so it was like, no, that looks weird.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Cameron, what's next on your list, sir?
Okay. Well, this is one that I think a lot of fans have talked about since Enterprise went off the air. Who was Future Guy?
Yeah,
The humanoid figure from the 28th century who we saw from Broken Bow trying to influence events with the Suliban. This character I found incredibly frustrating because, correct me if I'm wrong, is he the only real character, recurring character, who just, like, had such a heavy presence in sort of the mythology of the show to disappear?
Well, there's maybe another one that I want to bring up later on.
Okay.
Why don't I just get out of the way and we can have
go back and forth
between. What about Scylla?
Oh, good one. Yeah.
She was a very prominent recurring character who she just stopped appearing after the attempted coup to embed some Romulans on the planet Vulcan.
Right.
And then she just disappeared after that. That did not seem like the end of her arc, and yet it ended very abruptly, very much like Future Guy. Future Guy,
yeah,
it's just kind of like, okay. And I remember, look, even after I stopped watching the show on a week-to-week basis, I actually kept jumping onto the message boards and trying to find out if Future Guy's identity had been revealed yet.
Yeah.
And I was disappointed that, no, it had not. I was kind of annoyed as well.
Yeah, and I did some reading up on this character. I mean, they didn't even know who it was at all during the series, which to me is incredibly poor planning.
Yes.
You should know who it is, if only because it's going to help you with your scripting. Like, why are you using this character if you don't know what they are? You're going to then use them in ways that at some point are going to contradict the answer.
Did you ever have, like, your own theory, or who did you picture it being?
Honestly, I was in no way imaginative. I figured it was just some sort of, like, grand Suliban character that we were going to be introduced to later down the road. Like, essentially, it was a placeholder for something that was not cast.
I never thought it was a Suliban, because Future Guy was helping out the Suliban. Like,
not necessarily a Suliban, but, like, either, like, a grand Suliban or sort of some sort of collaborator with the Suliban, to me.
Well, yeah, because that's pretty on the nose.
It is, but like to me, it was just like going to be essentially like, imagine, you know, the Emperor from the original Star Wars films. You know, they were showing that Emperor on a view screen in Empire, but you could tell they didn't know what he looked like. He, at that point, was a woman's face with a monkey's eyes superimposed. And then when he shows up in Return, he doesn't look anything like that. Like, the future guy felt like an even more vague version of that, where they're like, we know this is a character that's going to, you know, pay off later, but we don't know what he looks like yet.
To me, I always thought there was, like, a mystery behind it. Like, I always thought, like, what character have we encountered could this be? So, I don't know, for a while, it's like, maybe it's Admiral Forrest.
Right.
Or maybe it's even Henry Archer, who's using this back in time, and he's worried about what his son Jonathan does in the future, even though Henry Archer's dead or something. Like, I was trying to, like, rationalize it in my brain for a long time, and there's just nothing satisfying. I think the reason why is the writers never even bothered with it.
Yeah, and I mean, they kind of piss away the temporal Cold War story in the Stormfront two-parter. Like, it's totally a hand wave of just like, okay, it's over. To me, this was always really frustrating. And even the like show's creative team can't even agree on what future guy was supposed to be. Manny Coto has said he's probably a Romulan, and this would have tied into the Romulan War in like season 5, or proposed season 5. Whereas Brandon Braga said it was Archer. It was future Archer who had been kept alive through like Suliban technology from the future.
That sounds like such a Brandon Braga sort of idea.
Yeah.
That could have been interesting.
And he said that it was future Archer trying to essentially correct history, kind of like a Terminator type thing. And that it doesn't surprise me that Brandon Braga would be influenced by the Terminator, of that idea of him having to go back and correct mistakes of the past. But then I'm like, when I'm looking at what this character did, the actions he's taken with the Suliban, it just is like, it sounds so convoluted to try and explain. Is like, no, that's Archer. Of course Archer's doing that.
Well, if we're on the topic of Enterprise, you brought up the Romulan War. Why don't I bring that up as well?
Let me just comment briefly on Sela, because you brought Sela up. To me,
Sela's
not as frustrating. She's frustrating in the sense it's a very flat ending to that character. But I feel
there was so much buildup.
Yes, exactly. It was all buildup, no payoff.
I know.
But
they were embedded, Cam.
They were embedded. In your mind, looking back on the series, you know, when she's beaten in unification, defeated, do you think in that moment they ever thought they were going to bring her back? Or do you think they thought this is the end of this character?
No, I think they thought they were going to bring her back and they just never had a good idea. And what disappoints me is that there would have been an obvious opportunity to bring her back for the Dominion War.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that they did not was frustrating. What do you think she was up to in the Dominion War? On the battle lines, behind the scenes, what kind of... Or do you think maybe she had just been shuffled off by Romulan Command? They were kind of sick of her little games that didn't seem to ever work out. Whether it's brainwashing Geordi or trying to get some... 3,000 Romulan soldiers embedded on Vulcan, and somehow 3,000 soldiers would be able to take over an entire planet?
Maybe they were embedding them on the changeling planet.
Ah, okay, there you go.
Like, we just aren't blending in very well. We're having trouble getting into the link.
Just, we keep stomping on the puddles.
They're like waiting water in the Great Link.
Like, oh, it's in my nose, man.
This sucks. Yeah. I mean, Sela to me also would have been really cool to see in like Star Trek Nemesis, in a world where you would carry that sort of continuity into the movies, which obviously they weren't going to do.
Yeah, that's definitely a missed opportunity. Because we had that Romulan sub-commander who was featured quite prominently, played by one Dina something or other.
Oh, Meyer?
Dina Meyer.
Yeah.
You know, why Dina Meyer? Why not, you know, one Denise Crosby? It would have been awesome to bring Denise Crosby back into the movies, right?
I know it just raises questions they don't want to answer as to who this character is. But it does feel like just a missed opportunity. It's like, you know, kind of like Future Guy. It's this character who's just kind of scuttled off unceremoniously. And we're left to just like ponder, who was this character?
Well, it makes you question why you even made an investment in the ongoing story in the first place if it wasn't ever going to pay off. And then you have to question, what should I not be invested in right now because it's never going to pay off? Like, that's why it's frustrating from a storytelling perspective.
Not only why did we invest ourselves, why did they invest themselves? Why did the writers put so much effort in?
Well, with regards to Future Guy, I think that was all mandated from the network. The network wanted serialized storytelling.
The temporal Cold War.
Yeah, so the writers were like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
And the writers really weren't invested in it. And I think that's a problem. If you don't have, you know, the storytellers really hook, line, and sinker into what they're telling stories about, then yeah, you're gonna end up with something like this.
But Sela, you had like what is it, 2 or 3 episodes building that character up.
Yeah,
and
I think she was in like at least 3 or 4 episodes, right?
Mind's Eye was one, right?
Yeah, and then Reunification Parts 1 and 2, and I think there's another one in there somewhere, wasn't there? Or she was revealed in...
Was she in Redemption? Like teased as like a shadow or something?
I think she was maybe teased as a shadow in Mind's Eye.
Okay, she was definitely in Mind's Eye. I remember that.
Yeah. So maybe it's just 3 episodes.
Right.
And maybe they... But still, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
All right. Romulan War, Cameron. This is something that I'm always thinking about with regards to kind of a missed opportunity in the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Mostly because the unanswered question that we got is it's very clear that they have a lot of Romulan infiltrators on Vulcan by the time that we're in season 4 of Enterprise.
Are they embedded?
They're embedded.
Yeah.
That's why it would have worked. all the sleeper agents from 100 years earlier would have been arisen and fought for Romulan justice. I don't know.
Sure.
Unification reference, people. Anyway, I wanted to see kind of, what we would have gotten with this Romulan war arc. This would have been a fantastic season 5 for, Enterprise that would have really fed into the mythology of Star Trek II.
And I feel, weirdly, more confident that Enterprise would have tackled the Romulan War with more sort of depth than, Discovery has with the Klingon War.
Yes.
I do think Enterprise would have delivered, just going off of what they did with the Zindi arc.
Well, do you think it's because we already knew what was going on with the characters? Because I'll say this, by the time we are at season 4, Manny Coto was a showrunner.
Yeah.
Whereas Brendan Braga was a showrunner for season 3, the Zindi arc there.
Yeah.
So it would have been a different producer telling this war story, essentially.
Yes.
So it makes me kind of wonder. I have total confidence in Manny Coto to pull this off.
Oh, definitely. You look at the arcs he did throughout season 4 of Enterprise. He really dug in deep into these, into the mythology of these stories in 3 episodes. Imagine what he'd do with a whole season or however long he would want to do this arc. I know he had other wacko ideas for season 5 of Enterprise, like the planet from... the Cloudminders. He wanted to, Stratos. He wanted to do a episode based on that. So I don't think he would have done
before they became like this caste society.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
He was really desperate to do that story. So I mean, that sounds crazy. I would have liked to have seen that. But I mean, I don't know that he would have done the Romulan War all season. But it would have been a significant amount of time, I think, to do it. And I would have really liked to have seen what he could have done, because he strikes me as often. Fans really want fans on the creative team. And I think often that backfires. I think a lot of times they hold it too precious.
I agree.
We've seen this over time of these filmmakers that sign on to do movies or whatever that are like, oh, they're hardcore fans. And then the movie's not very good or it's just too full of fan service. Manny Coto really strikes that perfect balance,
I
think, in season 4 of Enterprise, where he's working in elements of, the Mirror Universe, the Gorn, all of these classic TOS staples. But they feel true and they feel authentic and they don't feel just kind of like that leaning really awkwardly into fan service that something like, say, Star Trek Into Darkness does.
I agree.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think the Romulan War could have been really cool to see.
Do you think they would have killed off one of the main characters, though?
Mayweather?
Or, or give at least Trip a more ceremonious sort of ending if season 5 was going to be the last season?
Do you think... So let's say these are the voyages never happened.
Yeah.
Brandon Braga and Rick Berman were never tasked with writing this episode or chose to write this episode. Manny Coto finishes the series. Does Trip die?
No.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
So,
does anyone die?
Well, I think there needed to be some sort of sacrifice to make, because we've already seen this crew through the Zindi arc. And at a certain point, it just feels as if everybody becomes kind of invincible.
Do you think it would have been Shran? Because they talked about having Shran as the, joining the crew in the 5th season. Is Shran the type of character you kill because he's a recurring character the audience is invested in, but he's not one of your leads?
Well, he would have been a lead by season 5.
He would have been a lead at that point.
Yeah.
But leading up to that, he was a recurring.
But he would have been a main cast member in season 5. So I And honestly, I think he had a whole lot more to do than, say, a Hoshi or a Travis at that point. So I think people would have been more hard struck by Schran's death than they would have a Sato or a Mayweather death or a Reed.
Although, to be fair to Manny Cotto, like, he gave Mayweather actually a really good two-part episode in the Terra Prime and Demons, where it's not his episode, but like, he has way more to do and way more personality there. Like, it shows that Manny Cotto was willing to give these kind of characters often ignored by the series more material. So maybe he would have made us care more about Mayweather or Hoshi by the end of that.
And if they killed one of those two characters off and we were already invested in them, then, and if it meant, you know, good storytelling, then sure.
Maybe Reed. Reed might have been a good candidate too.
Yeah. I'm down for some Reed death. Yeah. All right.
Okay. Well, I will get to my next one. And I think it's one that people at home have been asking for a long, long time. Wesley and the Traveler.
Yeah, that was actually on my list, too.
Yeah.
I mean, don't know.
It's one you can't ignore if you're going to talk about Star Trek's Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, I don't know if... Okay, I think you're being a little you know, arch when you said it's what audiences at home have been wondering about.
I feel like it... No, I'm genuinely serious. Oh, okay. I think that is one that does jump to mind. Like, what happened with Wesley?
Because we know by Nemesis, he does come back.
Yes.
He's back in Starfleet.
Yes.
You know, because we see him in the background in a uniform.
Yeah.
So, and there's also a deleted scene, which non-canon, but still he explains that he's back in Starfleet, and it's kind of like, huh.
Yeah.
So becoming the human adventurer wasn't the right path for you, Wesley? Why is that? And it is weird because Wesley, and we've talked about it before, we even did an entire episode devoted to Wesley, where it seems like he's destined for more. All we hear is how he's a special person.
Yes.
So why does he need to go sit behind a console and type in like the bearings of a ship all day? Like, is that what he's really meant to do?
It seems strange. And I wonder how much of that is just the fact that like the writers set all this up and they really had no grand imagination for where this was going. It was more like just an exit door.
I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
You know, there was never any plans of a Wesley spinoff.
No.
So why don't we wrap up the character, you know, in a way? I'm sure this is probably dealt with in like a novel or something.
Oh, I'm sure it is, yeah.
But to me, I think I classify this as an unsolved mystery, but it's not something that bothers me the way that, say, Sela or Future Guy does, because this, you've wrapped up the character. The way that it does bug me, though, is he is brought back for Nemesis.
Right. I will say it does bother me in the sense that it's so abrupt and just out of nowhere.
But don't you buy that as the character's ultimate arc?
I mean, it makes sense given, yeah, he's like the child genius far beyond his years. But then you tie in the creepy traveler, and it just is like, none of it really meshes together in a way that feels... Like, I feel like when you get to that episode and Wesley is walking away to join the Traveler, you should have an emotional reaction to this. Like, you are seeing this character embark on a path that none of these other characters are going to be able to understand. And I feel nothing.
I think that has to do with execution, though. Journey's End was a very bad episode.
Yes.
And the Traveler was actually disguising himself as an aboriginal man the whole episode, and then all of a sudden he's the Traveler at the end.
Yeah.
And then you see them walk off together. It's really more the execution that sucks here. I think they could have done a great episode with Wesley eventually deciding he wants to get rid of his Starfleet career and go traveling with a traveling man.
How long has the Traveler been posing as this aboriginal man?
I think for... Well, it's very confusing.
Because he's hanging out with the others, and they...
Is he in the High Council or something?
Yeah, he is.
Has
he been, like, living an entire life there?
Or maybe...
Can the Traveler go back in time? We don't really know, right? He can go across dimensions.
It's so ambiguous with that character.
Ambiguous or lazy?
Yeah, I know. If I had to rationalize it in my brain, maybe he just disguised himself as the Aboriginal man for... like 5 minutes and wanted to chat with Wesley, but that's not what the show, that's not what the episode makes you want to believe, though. I think the episode leads you to believe that it's been this man this whole time observing Wesley throughout the episode.
Yes. I mean, how do the other Aboriginal people around this man on the council feel?
Maybe they're all travelers.
Oh, is this kind of like the Q Continuum where they're all in the Civil War?
Yeah.
But like the Aboriginal representation here is actually just all the travelers.
Perhaps.
That's amazing.
I don't know, that was such a bad episode, Cam.
It is. And to me, Wesley was often a mistreated character on that series. They just really didn't know what to do with him to a certain degree.
No.
But this just felt like a rushed and just kind of lazy exit. And I would have liked to have felt something. I know Wesley's ridiculed by a lot of fans. And, you know, since then, people are more nostalgic for him. But at the time, fans, I think, were just kind of done with him. But I just think you can't go wrong paying off a character with honesty and a certain amount of emotion.
No. And we got that.
Or sincerity.
But look, we totally got that with his episode, Final Mission.
Yes.
And I thought that was a great exit for the character. Yeah. And when you bring him back for an episode like First Duty or else The Game, those are like highlights of like Wesley's tenure on the series. You know, those are great showcase episodes.
Both of them, yeah.
And then you get Journey's End as his exit. And you're just like, okay. I don't know.
Although we saw season 7 was not great about Swan Song episodes.
No. Cam, one TNG character who we didn't really get a good exit for either, but I don't know if it bugs fans, but I really want to know whatever happened to Guinan. You know, we have the 10-4, it's destroyed on the Enterprise D. There's no civilians on the E. Does she open a new bar? We know she's there for the wedding of Riker and Troi. But beyond that, what has she been doing with herself? Because look, if you look between Generations and when Nemesis came out, it's essentially another 7-season series that we missed out on, all these adventures on the Enterprise E.
Right.
What's Guinan been doing with her time?
Guinan strikes me as a character that just is always drifting.
Yeah.
Like, she did her time on the Enterprise, and she's just off to the next sort of adventure.
She had a fun 6.5 years, yeah, and was like, okay. I got to hang out with one JLP for a little while, and go off to hang out with the next closest thing to one Samuel Clemens in the 24th century.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, maybe she was going to hang out with Samuel Clemens.
Or maybe she went and reconciled with her father. We do know that we don't know much about Guinan, but we know she and her father did not get along. Although I suspect her dad's probably dead from the Borg attack.
Probably, yeah.
Almost everyone is.
Do you think the show should have answered questions about Guinan by the end?
No. Yeah. I think she's best left as a mystery.
Right.
An unsolved mystery, Cam. One of Star Trek's unsolved mysteries.
Do you think the show ever revisits that alien race?
The Elorians.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
The listener people. No, because I also found it kind of a frustrating species in that we never really knew what Guinan's abilities were.
Yeah.
We never knew.
We just knew like Q was intimidated by her, but we never really knew why.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
They've encountered each other, and they're good at listening, and she can sense if the universe is askew, like in yesterday's Enterprise.
Right.
I just never really had a good grasp on the Elorians.
Maybe she's actually just riding that merry-go-round in the Nexus for eternity.
Maybe she's stuck in the Nexus, never came out.
How horrific.
Yeah. Although, no, in all fairness, I do want fans to realize that we realize that that was just Guinan's echo.
Yes, her echo, yeah.
Her echo in the Nexus. Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, like this character seems to have powers that go far beyond anything other than really Q. I kind of like the idea that Guinan is, you know, close to as powerful as like a Q. And it's just like, I'm just going to hang out on the Enterprise D for a while. And then she's going to just go do something else.
Like,
she's just kind of journeying the cosmos, taking in adventures and learning about, you know, people.
We all have those friends who you don't hear from them for like 2 or 3 years, and then you find out they've been like backpacking barefoot across the Himalayas for...
Are you talking about fallen co-host Benjamin Young?
We hope he's back from the Himalayas one day, listeners. It'll happen soon enough.
He went in search of the Yeti, and we've never heard from him again.
He'll resurface. He always does.
Sure. Not on this show, though.
No, that's true. He's got other podcasts to flake out on.
Yeah.
I would only care if I thought that he listened.
Yeah.
Anyways, so we've all got those friends. I think Guinan.
Yeah.
But do you think Guinan and Jean-Luc get another shot at an extended period together?
That was the lingering question I had about that, because I don't think Guinan's like, I've got to keep up my friendship with Riker.
You're right.
You know, but the Picard bond,
that's
seems
a very, very important bond.
Yes, and it seems intimate in a way that none of her other relationships did on the show, and to me it carries more weight.
To me there's also that ambiguity about whether there is any sort of like sexual relationship between them.
Although, according to Whoopi Goldberg, she was like his great-great-great-great-grandmother or something.
Yeah. But then we watch a lot of these episodes, and there's like kind of this sexual undertone between these characters that you wouldn't really necessarily always think about on the surface anyway.
To be fair, do you think Whoopi Goldberg watched the show? Because actors often don't watch, you know, the episodes of these shows.
No, that's true. But
she may have played it away, but the way that the show presents it is different than what maybe she had in her mind.
I think Patrick Stewart only watched the episodes he directed.
Yeah.
I don't think he watched other episodes.
Right.
I think Whoopi Goldberg was a fan of the series, right, of the franchise. I think she watched those episodes.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
well, she didn't view anything sexual in those interactions then.
But, you know, it's all open to interpretation. Yeah. I mean, that she's the actress. I'm the viewer. My mind always goes to the gutter. So that's why I'm
sure.
Yeah. But didn't you pick up on, you know, what I'm talking about?
No,
here?
I completely. 100%.
Yeah.
It is interesting to me that sort of these higher powers in the cosmos, you know, between her and Q are both like fascinated with Picard.
I'd be too. Yeah.
Okay. Especially when he had those forearms in the movies.
Oh, yeah. Cam, you may have, like, okay. You may have spoiled my next one, but I want to hear yours first.
Okay, well, this is another one that I think fans are going to want to hear us mention. And it's the Sisko, Does He Return?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it was interesting because I didn't really delve into sort of like the novels or anything for most of these questions. But that one, I was just curious to see how they just kind of explained why he's back in these books. And I got to be honest, when I read like the synopsis, I was like, I don't really like those interpretations of what happened, of him just coming back on his daughter's birthday and then going to serve aboard the USS Robinson. I'm like, wow, that's not interesting to me.
No, because you and I, we discussed it, how we think that after he went to the Celestial Temple, he's never coming back with the intention of re-enlisting in Starfleet.
Yeah.
We even know that Sisko is telling Admiral Ross, after the war ends, I'm retiring, I'm going to Bajor, and I'm building a home on Bajor.
That part they did carry over into the novels, was him moving to Bajor.
Okay.
Which, that part, yeah, I like that too, because that is him finding his home, essentially. DS9's all about these characters who really don't have a home, finding one on DS9 and then moving onwards and hopefully finding another home. But
okay.
I like the idea that Sisko figured out what his home was while on DS9, you know, that it would be on Bajor. But yeah, like, to me, Sisko, when he becomes, you know, when he goes into the fire caves with Dukat and whatever, and we should have just a little sub part at the end of this of just did Dukat ever return as well. But to me, when
maybe in like 20,000 years.
When Sisko does return, to me, he's kind of following in the footsteps of like a Decker Ilya type thing. Like, what Sisko has seen is so far beyond, I feel like, what Starfleet would offer.
Yeah, but then it also makes me worried about, like, how does he readjust and reestablish those relationships with Jake and Cassidy and
his new daughter?
Yeah, like,
how does he have this romantic relationship, like, with Cassidy?
Would
after
he just,
you've kind of, you know, kind of visited the, at least the alien version of the Almighty.
But I don't know, maybe it's not as special as we're making it out to be. Maybe
it's really disappointing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like just a waiting room for Beetlejuice.
It's like him shucking clams like he did in the season 6 finale. You're like, that's the cliffhanger? Sisko shucks clams?
Yeah.
Okay.
Him and Dukat wound up in the exact same place. He's like, what the hell?
Or maybe they realized they had to stage all of those, you know, those prophet interventions we'd get intermittently throughout the series?
Yeah.
They realized that was their job. They had to, like, dictate everything that was going on, and they got really bored really quickly,
right,
of all this ambiguous talk between, like, characters.
How much communication do you think there was, you know, after Sisko takes his dive into this sort of alternate world? How much interaction do you think he has with those prophet voices? Because it seems like that would be a little maddening after, you know, a few minutes.
It's tough because, well, he was the one who explained to them linear time, right?
Yes.
So maybe he's brought them to his level.
Mm-hmm.
They have to elevate him to their level, I guess. So maybe he would figure it out. Or to me, I have to be honest, whatever happened to Sisko in the Celestial Temple, it doesn't interest me at all.
Right.
Like I'm not interested at all in that aspect of the character. To me, it's mostly what happens when he comes back.
Yes,
from that.
For sure.
That's
for
what
sure.
I care about.
But if he is learning about nonlinear time, and he comes back, though. How does one adjust when you know the future? You know, like, you would spend so much time not being invested in things because you would feel above it to a certain degree.
But the thing is, we don't even know what happened to him in the Celestial Temple.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's why it's so hard to... I mean, I would assume he's a little aloof, and I'd assume his experience affects him.
Yeah.
I don't think this is going to be an unsolved mystery for long, though. Because,
oh, really?
No, because we do have the season 8... story coming out from the writers of Deep Space Nine. This is part of the What We Left Behind documentary that I mentioned earlier.
That's right, yeah.
So we are going to find out what happened to Sisko.
Oh, wow.
In
that's
the season
exciting.
8, the hypothetical
totally
season 8 premiere.
I totally forgot about that. Yeah, I totally forgot. Wow.
And Tom Riker makes a return, too. The corpse of Tom Riker.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, okay, just I kind of made a joke about it, but do you think Dukat is ever released? Because, you know, he's gone with the Paw race down to... You know, into the fire or whatever. But if Sisko can come back, can Dukat come back?
I'd say just no.
Yeah, no.
You've got to seal this guy's fate. That's it. And I was only half joking, but if he ever comes back, it's in like 20,000 years.
Definitely.
And he's contained by some Bajoran priests in some bucket or something like that where
right.
he's never getting out of that.
Right.
Yeah. What do you think?
I could see him becoming some sort of evil that's unleashed. Like, I don't want to... I'm not ever... Please, God, don't anyone at home mistake me for pitching this as, like, a story I want to see on a future Star Trek episode. Not at all. But I could see that sort of story existing. Like, kind of like the essence of Dukat being brought forward.
I would find it so tedious to watch. Well, it's just... don't you feel you've kind of seen this before?
It exists in a different... genre, essentially.
But,
the types of sci-fi that Star Trek is, it wouldn't make sense, but you could see it more in like something a little more fantasy-oriented.
But that's the problem with the final few seasons of DS9 is when they started getting into the Costa Mojin and there's magic spells, and I don't want to see Dukat brought back as an evil spirit. I'm just like, it gets into the really cheesy territory.
The Paw Wraiths just never 100% worked very well.
No.
And I would be curious to know how the writers feel about them now, if they feel like they ever would have interest in examining that anymore.
Maybe I'll get a chance to ridicule Ira Stephen Bear once again in front of his face in the next Star Trek convention, all about the Paw Wraiths.
Because I think they have a certain amount of pride in what they did with the wormhole aliens, but I would be curious how they felt about the Paw Wraiths.
Yeah. So, Cam, I kind of teased it, but you were kind of pushing about like some of the Picard mysteries that might exist. You know, you mentioned how did his arms get so big between films? But I want to know, like, how did Picard loosen up so much? Like, that's one of the big unsolved mysteries for me, is he goes from this very stiff kind of dude. All of a sudden, he is, you know, kissing women in front of hummingbirds. He's going on dune buggy rides, you know. I want to know what it really was that, you know, from those first 7 seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation, he was a stiff dude, let's be honest. But you get into the, especially the latter movies, I mean, that man, he knows how to have a fun. He knows how to, you know, do the marumba.
Right. First off, I don't think there's any logical explanation for the writing of Picard in those films. I think a lot of it just has to do with Patrick Stewart having more creative control and wanting to be more of an action hero. But if I am going to try and explain it with the sort of the text of the series, I think you could make the argument that a lot of the show has been about Picard recognizing that the crew is his family and how important they are to him. And when we have All Good Things and him sitting down at that poker game, maybe that's sort of him willing, especially after the experiences of All Good Things and looking at the past and realizing how far he's come and what his future could be, maybe realizing that he needs to lighten up in the future. Like that sitting down at the poker table was like the first step in sort of a more mellow, open Picard.
I like that interpretation and that, like,
it's all I've got.
But, you know, the poker table, like, you did get the sense, like, he's actually starting to come around and starting to change. I don't know if generations necessarily serve that so well, But
it didn't serve anything very well.
I know, but
maybe he saw Kirk like chopping wood, and he was like, "Oh, I don't want this to be my future."
No kidding. Yeah, maybe that's just it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It just to me, it was just such a mystery how we got to where Picard ends up in the movies, where he seems like an entirely different character. He seems more like a Patrick Stewart, less so a JLP.
Well, you can just see them when they're putting those movies together. Being like, the audience has to find him likable. And that coming from the studio, not from the writers. Like, the captain, he's the star, he's got to be likable.
He can't yell at children.
Yeah, he's got to be, he's too stiff. You know, it's just not working. You got to make him more fun. I could totally see studio heads saying that.
Is this the same studio that gave the okay to our introduction to Picard as he's blubbering over the photo album in Generations?
Crying over Robert.
Yeah. That's the same studio? Like, you guys got a winner there.
Possibly, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's definitely like makes him more relatable to a certain degree to the audience because he's not, you know, bottling up his emotions. It's like he's an emotional person. You know, don't you feel sad because he feels sad? Like, you can totally see kind of the backwards logic of how the studio would want this character to be portrayed, because the thing is, they were spoiled to a certain degree with Kirk, and that Kirk wears his emotions on his sleeve a lot of the time. And for a studio that probably doesn't give a crap at all about the Next Generation series, they're like, well, look, the Kirk films were very successful. People like Captain Kirk because he's, you know, screaming Khan, which I don't really think they think about that, what that even means. But he's a character who's like big and exciting and, you know, action-packed. And I don't think they were like, we want these films to really honor your TV series.
Cam, you're giving way too much credit to the studio for like introducing like your protagonist as like this Weeping Willow kind of character. And like, go listen to the commentaries for Generations. Brandon Braga and Ron Moore take full responsibility for that scene, and they ridicule themselves for writing it.
Okay.
You know, they say it just doesn't work, and it's not the way you introduce your protagonist into a story.
Do you think that Picard was ever a character who would have made the transition to films intact? Just going off the way that studios looked at lead characters in those types of movies then.
In the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, this is kind of the Die Hard, Mission Impossible, Lethal Weapon era.
You know, nowadays with like Marvel making movies, they're, say, more true to a character. Like, you'll see someone who's like a Doctor Strange, and you can see how a Picard might make the transition much better now.
Yeah.
But in that era, when they want to make hit films, and sci-fi means like Independence Day sort of stuff, I don't think you're going to get a Picard who's true to the series. I just don't think it would ever have... Not that it wouldn't have worked, but I don't think they ever would have pulled the trigger on that.
I think what they needed to do is have like a big time gap between the series of the movies, much like we had with the original series. Like, so maybe 2004.
Yeah.
Maybe you would have gotten something post-Gladiator.
Sure.
You know,
that was a huge influence on Nemesis.
Well, as John Logan wrote the script
for
that as well as for Nemesis. So,
yeah.
Bam. Brought it home for you, man.
Romans, Remans. It all lines up.
Wow. All right.
So I had one that we teased at the end of last week's episode. I think we just need to touch on.
Okay.
What is the future of the Voyager crew? Because, you know, we see an Endgame. They're all coming home. We never got the real sense of closure I think we did with the other series. You know, like, you look at the DS9 finale, you get so much closure as to where these characters are going in their lives, at least for the short term. What happened with the Voyager crew?
Well, I think the writers are trying to spell it out for the audiences with the flash forwards.
Sure,
that
but
are
kind of...
now in an alternate timeline, so it doesn't really work for me at all.
Right.
And it's such a bad finale in that, like, you're led to believe, you know, that this crew's going on this big journey, and you're going to get some sort of catharsis along with them.
Yes.
When they make it home. And all we see is the ship moving into the direction of, I think there's other ships embracing them or something like that. And you don't get that moment of catharsis, which is so disappointing. So what is the crew up to?
I was going to say,
we do know what happens to Janeway. Janeway is an admiral, but we do see that in Star Trek Nemesis.
Yes, for sure.
7 of 9, I got to believe she's going to Starfleet Academy, having some awkward Sadie Hawkins dances, as we heard from Data.
Right.
She's getting enlisted as an ensign. She's going to have to serve under Nog. There's going to be some wacky adventures.
You think she does continue with Starfleet, huh?
I think that's ultimately, yeah, what she ends up doing. I think it's from the influence that Janeway had on her.
Right. My only question mark with her was whether she becomes more, when she kind of gets back to Earth, is more invested in kind of figuring out who she is. Does she kind of cast Starfleet aside, at least for a while?
I think she does that. She continues that human journey, human adventure.
Yeah.
In Starfleet.
Okay. Yeah.
Neelix, I'm fine with knowing Neelix is living on a meteor.
Yeah, he stays there.
Yeah.
Right?
Tom and B'Elanna, they've got a kid. Do they continue serving together, or are they separated on two different ships?
Yeah, especially when they've got kids.
Yeah. The other thing is, well, okay, so B'Elanna was enlisted on, but she was not ever a commissioned officer.
Right.
So I wonder what that actually spells for their future. Tom, like, again, he was not a commissioned officer on Voyager, but he was given the pips because everybody else died.
Yeah.
So they're both not officially commissioned Starfleet officers. So I really wonder what that even means for their future.
Do you feel these characters were passionate about continuing with Starfleet? Like, when you look at them, do they feel like career officers, or do they feel like once they got home, they're like, we made it home, we want to go live our lives?
They don't feel like career officers, but I don't know what else they would do with their lives.
Well, they can open a restaurant like Joe Sisko. Like, they can do whatever they want in Earth of the 24th century.
Do you picture them working at a Papa Murphy's? Like, I don't.
That was my go-to, obviously.
Okay.
I don't know, like,
What do you picture them doing?
Tom is so obsessed with, like, 20th century pop culture.
Yeah.
Maybe he opens a museum of pop culture.
And what's B'Elanna doing?
I don't know.
She would not be working there.
No.
I think she'd be, like, rolling her eyes.
Yeah. Do you, like, think that, like, I don't know, does Tom Paris strike you as someone who would continue to do the Starfleet thing, or would he be driven by his own interests? Because he's very passionate. Like, he's more passionate about his interest than a lot of the other Star Trek characters are.
But I'll say this. I think so much of his character arc was informed by his father's disapproval of him. And now that he's got his father's approval, maybe he just wants to keep eating it all up. And maybe he continues on. Maybe he somehow gets a commendation from Admiral Janeway and he's able to reenlist in Starfleet.
Or does he just become, like, a popular Holo novel author?
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. I don't picture Tom and B'Elanna really giving it up for civilian life.
Right.
You know, I don't know what B'Elanna would do in civilian life. She is like an engineer. She needs to be fixing things.
I was going to say, B'Elanna's, she seems very much driven to be a really good engineer.
Yeah.
More so than Tom as like, like he likes racing.
Yeah. But out of everyone that I see giving up, say, Starfleet, I see it's the Doctor. I see the Doctor's like, I don't need to be aboard a ship, you know, suturing people up. I'm going to go sing opera. He already quit Voyager once and to sing opera on an alien planet, which I hated that episode.
Virtuoso?
Yeah. So I picture the Doctor pursuing other things, you know. What about you?
I agree with you. I could totally see him wanting to do other things. Because, I mean, he is the first holographic character to really have the ability to do whatever he wants. Why would he do what he was initially programmed to do when he has the choice to do something else?
I picture Harry sticking around in Starfleet.
Oh, hell yeah. Harry is
He might get a promotion one of those days.
He is going to be a career officer. Maybe one day he's a captain far off in the future at the rate he's going.
Yeah.
What about Chakotay? Does he become a captain? Because we talked in our first Officers, I think, episode, that we could never see him wanting or like stepping up to captain. He would kind of be like a career first officer. Do you still feel the same way?
I think he finds a nice beach in Tahiti and opens up a tattoo parlor.
Does he marry 7 of 9?
No. Yeah. I think that's just fantasy there.
Right.
Let's be honest, those kids had no chemistry. I don't want to picture that.
No.
Does he remain? I would not want to serve under a Captain Chakotay.
No.
So maybe he sticks around as a first officer. But again, he's not. So he was a commissioned officer in Starfleet at one point.
Yes.
And then he left to join the Maquis, which was an illegal outlaw group as far as the Federation concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Is he facing some sort of comeuppance when he gets home? Is he going to have to go in front of a court martial or something like that and answer for that? Or do they all give them all kind of a pat on the back and say, okay, guys, you've been through enough?
I think Janeway's word is probably getting them all off the hook.
So do you think he is reenlisting in Starfleet at this point? He's already in once. Can he go back?
The only thing I could think of as an alternative is he's more interested in going back to his roots, essentially.
Okay.
Because he did talk... With the
rubber tree people.
Yeah. I could see him maybe going back to that way of life. Because to me, Chakotay is such a blank character. That's the only alternative I really have, because the Maquis basically done.
Right. Okay.
So he may wear a vest more, though.
Oh, I would hope so.
And I love that you pretty much, I think, forgotten Tuvok.
No, I remember Tuvok? I was going to remember, I was going to bring up Tuvok, but
it would have been funnier if you'd forgotten him.
Then you brought up Chakotay. Yeah. Tuvok, I see him going back with his family. I see him hanging up the uniform and saying, yeah, I'm just going to go spend time with my family now. And I totally buy that. Kes, we already kind of...
Well, did we?
She turns into...
Energy. But was that just her next state of being? Was that the human adventure continuing?
That's the O'Cuppin adventure.
Yeah. So does she just, I don't know. Was that the end of her, or was that
I think
a
that's
new
the
beginning?
End of her.
Was that like a metamorphosis?
I think it's the end of her.
Okay. Okay. So did you have one to close out on? Or?
Yeah. Why don't we talk about some lingering mysteries, some unsolved mysteries with regards to, we haven't done this yet. And how have we not, Cam? Star Trek Discovery.
All right.
We're at the, for those who are listening in the year 2025.
This is aging so well, this episode.
I know. We are at the mid-season finale of the very first season ever. So we just left off with Into the Forest I Go. And there's still like some unsolved mysteries about this series. There's a lot of ambiguity about, say, what Lorca is really up to, what Laurel really is up to. I want to know what is going on with... You recall those black badges in episode 3?
Yeah.
Where Burnham specifically says, what's up with those black badges? And we never see another guy wearing black badge again.
They really did underline that one, too. Like, and I mean, to the degree that, you know, fans are all over Facebook being like, it must be Section 31. It must be Section 31. Yeah. Like,
they're like, look at the registry. It says 31 on the Discovery, which I thought was like...
Like, they really hammered home those black badges.
Yeah.
And so far, we have seen no mention of them ever again.
They're in one episode out of 9.
Which is really weird.
What do you think's going on with that? And because these guys were clearly guarding a room.
The way that serialized TV is written, I feel like they're going to come back to it. I don't think they would have forgotten already. It would seem very strange.
But if they had, why not just cut that moment out? Like, it seems so easy to cut out.
This has to pay off. Like, it has to.
But is it going to be disappointing, Cam?
Possibly. Do you think they've made a mistake in not subtly showing them since? Because it's kind of like, is it a successful payoff if fans have kind of, you know, or people have kind of forgotten by the time you get around to it?
I think there needs to have been at least one other acknowledgement in the interceding, like, five episodes.
Or maybe had, like, you know, a character like Landry wearing one or something. Like, had some sort of supporting character who wore one or something? I don't know. Like, just some sort of way that where it keeps it visually in your mind.
Because the problem would be Burnham's like, hey, Landry, what's up with that black Delta you're wearing?
That's not for you to know.
Yeah. Okay.
The answers will come later.
But then Burnham's like, hey, see Landry with that black Delta on? What do you think the deal is with that?
We don't talk about that with outsiders or mutineers.
Yeah. Although maybe she's asking those questions of those two dudes that we already saw wearing the Deltas.
Yeah.
I don't know. And this is a very small crew. I think people keep forgetting, like, this is I think they established only like 134 people aboard,
right,
which is the smallest crew to date if you forget about Defiant. And that's only intermittently crewed.
Or Star Trek III, where Kirk and. His people just head off to find Spock in the Enterprise crew.
Yeah. So I don't know. It just seems weird that you'd have at least a few guys wearing black Deltas, and Burnham doesn't seem to care that much.
Yeah.
Or at least she doesn't anymore.
I think Discovery has done a fairly good job with a lot of its ongoing sort of teases and story arcs and what have you. This one, not so much.
This is an unsolved mystery that a lot of our future listeners are going to be like, these guys are so dumb.
Here's
it's so obvious, people.
Here's the question. Do you think they tease it again, or do you think they just kind of give some sort of resolution to it out in, you know, in one episode coming up?
I don't think we're getting a resolution to it until further in. I don't think we're going to get a hint when we come back from the mid-season hiatus.
Okay.
So I would say it's probably something that's going to pay off maybe at the very end of the season.
Right.
So that's only, what, 6 more episodes, right?
Do you think that they're, like, acknowledging the black badges, or it's just, like, it's going to have some sort of reveal where they can be, like, remember the black badges? You know what I mean? Like, it was kind of like this subtle hint that a lot of people, the casual viewer has probably forgotten about completely, but they can kind of point back to it as, like, this moment, as opposed to it being an actual, like, kind of breadcrumb trail.
I mean, it's so hard to say, though, because, like,
yeah,
it just doesn't even make sense why people, if you're in Black Ops, wouldn't you want to be kind of concealed? And like, why would you want to draw attention to yourself wearing a black badge? Everyone's going to be asking you about it, just like Burnham was in the first episode, just like I am right now.
Yeah.
It just seems like really dumb. I don't think it's going to pay off in a way that anybody finds satisfying.
I guess we can only wait and see. So, Tyler, did the Ortonville have a new adventure this week? A human adventure, if you will.
No, it's on reruns, but I'll be back next week. So
okay.
I think there's only 2 more episodes left. They actually produced 13 episodes, but they're only going to air 12. And we're going to get episode 13. It'll air next season. I don't know if I'm going to include that in my review, because I already promised not to come back for season 2. But I'm curious how they stick the landing for the inaugural season of The Orville.
Okay, well, I can't wait to find out. We had some incoming transmissions just in regards to last week's episode of Most Badass Characters in Star Trek. I wanted to give a shout out to Jason Carr, who named one that I'm frankly embarrassed that I didn't mention, which is he said, in TOS, if you're doing one-off characters, then I'm surprised you left off Kang in Day of the Dove, and his badassery spanned 2 Star Trek series between that and Deep Space Nine. This one I'm genuinely embarrassed about, because I actually referenced Kang in one of our YouTube videos, like, I think recorded the week earlier. And so that character should have been fresh in my mind. I was wrong.
But would you call him one of the most badass characters of all time?
Well, we went series by series. I should have named him. I would have ranked him over Khan, and we named Khan from the original series.
But we were kind of, like, hesitant about Khan.
Kang is, I think, yes.
Okay.
I'm a little embarrassed about forgetting Kang. So.
And you have so many things to be embarrassed about, so it's interesting so that this many. One rises to the top.
Yeah, that one, when as soon as I read it, I just, like, smacked my forehead.
I smacked your forehead, too.
And he then also wanted to know if we had any love for Kelvin versus Sulu and his fencing skills.
Well, to me, I think that's a badass moment.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would call Kelvin versus Sulu one of the most badass characters in all Star Trek, though.
He couldn't start the ship properly.
That's true. But I actually saved him.
Yeah, he did.
So,
I mean, maybe he deserves extra points just for, like, that moment where he's, like, pretending to be a captain. Or he was serving as captain, essentially.
Into Darkness?
Into Darkness. And then also running the ship off, like, the cliff in Beyond. But again, it's
not,
moments. Yeah.
It's moments. It's not a character who's just badass. Yeah. That's my argument anyway.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And then the other controversial figure we talked about in that episode was Gul Dukat. And, you know, I was very much fist pumping for him in season 4, where he's flying around in his Klingon bird of prey. And, you know, you had feelings that, you know, he's not a character to be championed as a badass. We had some comments on that. William Richardson said, Dukat was both a badass and a slimeball. I mean, the dude was pure evil in a cool sort of way.
No.
You know what? I would argue he had elements of that in the early seasons, where he had that sort of, like, he's evil, but then they give him lots of moments where he just looks like the guy who knows how to do everything. To me, it's like when we talked about wrongs. Was it Wrong's Darker Than Night or whatever? The episode where we find out his relationship with Kira's mom. Like,
in
a certain point in the series, they're like, okay, we're done flirting with this sort of villain who's cool. We're going to make him awful. Like, maybe they felt a little guilty about doing that, given the shades of Nazism to the character. Because they definitely finally just said, no, this character is despicable. But I do think early on there were shades of that, like, yeah, he's awful, but he's also the character you kind of love to hate.
to me, if you're just slimy out of the gate, and he was always a slimy guy, I don't think you could ever be badass.
Right.
That's just kind of the problem with the definition of badass.
Okay, well, guest the show, David Boris, who was on our Dominion War episode, which you should check out. Very good episode. Lots of Ducat talk on there. He says, Ducat was badass in a non-celebratory way, as he was pretty much a Nazi, but he was the baddest of the bad.
I would say
it's interesting that that turned out to be kind of the polarizing one we talked about.
Ducat as a badass.
Yeah, yeah.
I think a lot of people kind of identify him as like, oh, that's it's Star Trek's number one villain, right?
Yes.
So you usually think of like villains as kind of, oh, badass sort of.
We did reference Khan as a badass.
Yeah.
Possibly, you know. So.
But you know. Is Khan, would you call him slimy?
Well, I think in Space Seed he's a little slimy towards like the female crew member.
Domestic violence and all that. But slimy is not the first adjective people would use to describe Khan, but I think it would be for Ducat.
I wonder if I would feel differently about Khan if I'd seen more of his crimes and what have you during like the his rule, like when he was in power,
where he's like engaging in genocide.
Yes.
Yeah,
because the thing is with Khan, it's all kind of just like talked about briefly, like it's kind of alluded to, but we're only presented with kind of Ricardo Montalban's ultra charismatic performance. Gul Dukat, we are constantly hit with these reminders as to all the things he did. You know, obviously our feelings towards him, and having a character like Kira who was impacted very personally by what he did, Khan didn't have that.
Yeah.
And so we feel, I think, a little differently about the two. But I you know, again, thanks for the feedback, guys. And I'm glad that people had disagreements on who's badass and who isn't. So
you and I included.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. Please join the conversation over at our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We will have more videos going up there again this week, and who knows what other conversations will take place. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
We've been talking about this camp for a while, but we want to tackle the evolution of the Klingons, and we finally figured out a way in which it would not be so unwieldy, in which we try to highlight all the greatest hits when it comes to Klingon episodes. So please, if you're curious about the Klingons, especially how they're fitting into the current Star Trek Discovery lore, we're going to go in depth on them, but it's going to be handled in a way that I think is going to be very digestible to listeners, and I think for you and I as hosts as well.
Yeah, it's not going to be us racing through like
150 episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With 10 seconds each sort of thing. No, no. We've got, I think, a format that's going to be really cool and fun. So you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Voyager, the Human Adventure, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's Reporton. N as in not a badass.
Okay. So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.